And good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. We have a fun show for you this morning. Our first guest, Graham Simison, author of the critically acclaimed Rosie Project. The protagonist for this fictional read is Don Tillman, who's a brilliant professor of genetics, rigidly committed to a structured schedule, speaks without a filter, interprets statements literally, and, well, he's socially inept. He's never been on a second date, and he has decided to find a wife. He designs a 16-page questionnaire called The Wife Project, and the adventure begins. Lynn, I love this character. You just can't help wanting him to succeed as he tackles and is often tackled by life.
He's a great character, and he shows hope for scientists.
And all of us.
We all, that's right. And our second guest this morning is Alex Bellows, author of The Grapes of Math, How Life Reflects Numbers and Numbers Reflect Life. Alex Bellows has a degree in mathematics and philosophy from Oxford University, curator in residence at the Science Museum, and he's the Guardian's math blogger. He's worked in London and Rio de Janeiro, where he was the paper's unusually numerate foreign correspondent. In 2002, he wrote Football, a critically acclaimed book about Brazilian football. And in 2006, he ghost wrote Pelé's autobiography, which was a number one bestseller. This guy does it all, from triangles, rotations, and power laws to cones, curves, and the dreaded calculus. The Grapes of Math takes you on a journey of mathematical discovery. It'll be a great conversation.
Yeah. Well, these two guests, plus today's cool story when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Nexus IT is proud to have supported KPCW for the past 10 years. Nexus IT provides on-premise and cloud voice over IP, phone systems, and service that simplify and unify your business telecommunications. 435-487-9099, nexusitc.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest, Graham Simison, author of The Rosie Project. The main character, Don Tillman, brilliant yet socially inept professor of genetics. He's decided it's time he found a wife. In the orderly, evidence-based manner in which Don approaches all things, he designs The Wife Project to find his perfect partner. It's a 16-page, scientifically valid survey to filter out the drinkers, the smokers, the late arrivers. Rosie Jarman possesses all of these qualities, and she's immediately disqualified as a candidate for The Wife Project. But Don's forced to confront the spontaneous whirlwind that is Rosie, and the realization that despite your best scientific efforts, you don't find love, it finds you. Graham, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah. Now, Graham, you're a former IT consultant and the author of two nonfiction books on database design. The Rosie Project, the book we're, of course, talking about, is your first novel. It's also been optioned by Sony Pictures, so congratulations with that.
Thanks very much. It's a bit of a change from what I was writing before, certainly.
Yes. Now, your technical background, you have a background in data modeling. Is that correct?
That's right. And for your listeners who aren't quite sure what I mean, and sometimes the word data modeling is used to mean two quite different things. I'm not a statistician. I'm a database designer, basically. Data modeling is, broadly speaking, database specification. So just as an architect specifies a house, a data modeler specifies a database for somebody to build.
And the protagonist in this this fascinating book, The Rosie Project, is Don Tillman. He's brilliant professor of genetics. He's really committed to a structured schedule and life. He speaks without a filter. He kind of interprets things literally. He's a little socially awkward. He's never been on a second date. And he puts together the 16-page questionnaire called The Wife Project when he decides he's going to find a partner.
That's right.
So the first question I have is, well, I guess I've asked a couple questions, is your background in data modeling, did that help you with this piece of the book?
Not a lot, to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Except that I did a PhD in data modeling, doing research there, and had to construct server. My interest was how people went about the task, and I needed to construct surveys to ask people about their approach to data modeling, about background and so forth. And because I had to do that rigorously, I did learn something about survey construction and how it was done. So that was useful in writing the book.
So he decides he wants a partner. He puts together a filter to keep out the disorganized, the time wasters, the horoscope readers, the scientifically illiterate. He doesn't want a smoker. He doesn't want a vegan. He doesn't want someone that's tardy or a couch potato. And this woman comes along, Rosie Jarman, who basically checks all of those boxes. And he begins a friendship with her.
None of those boxes.
Excuse me?
Well, she checks none of those boxes.
Exactly.
He specifies his perfect woman, and
she's the opposite.
He wants a non-drinker, she's a drinker. He wants a non-smoker, she's a smoker.
Yeah.
Well, and it goes back, even though Don Tillman would never have suspected that opposites attract, which may be in part his own, personality traits, or maybe we should just call it his Asperger's, that this sort of thing can work. But he's fascinated with Rosie because she's also on a project. And talk about her project. It's not really finding a husband.
No, she wants to find a father. Her mother had a one-night stand on the night of her graduation with one of the other men in her graduating medical year. And she married somebody else. But this man is Rosie's father, this fellow medical student. And Rosie's mother has taken the secret to her grave. And Rosie desperately wants to know who her biological father is. And she enlists Don to help her find that man by surreptitious DNA testing.
Hmm. So I'm wondering, Graham, as you get into the story and you're shaping these characters, so much of them are really current themes. I mean, these days it's very current and fashionable and trendy even to be a scientist, to have a STEM, a science, technology, engineering, and mathematic background. It's what we're pushing our children towards. And so talk a little bit, if you would, about shaping these characters into such likable people, but at the same time, they're kind of following some stereotypes.
Yeah, well, look, let me tell you, I'm in my 50s, and when I was growing up, it certainly wasn't fashionable to be a scientist. Well, it might have been fashionable in the broader sense of being a good career to choose, but it didn't get you dates.
Yeah, exactly.
Geeks were not sexy back then.
Aren't you glad they are now?
Yeah, but I didn't so much have that in mind. I guess it wasn't until I was writing the book and after it was published that I got really strong feedback about just how acceptable someone like Don Tillman is, potentially as a date, as a partner. It was a little bit of an eye-opener for me. I wanted to write Don as a sympathetic character because he's the sort of guy who often gets laughed at without a great deal of sympathy. Often the Don Tillmans, the people with Asperger's, if you like, are secondary characters in stories. They're not well understood. They're just there for laughs. And I wanted there to be a lot of laughs, but I wanted some of the laughs to be on us. And at the end of it, I wanted us to really feel for this guy, and not just feel sorry for him, but feel he was a worthy human being, and perhaps encourage a little more acceptance of people like him.
And I had a technology background for a career, and I knew a bunch of Dons, and I really got a kick out of the character that you developed. And for all of his quirks, and he had a terrible dating history, and he was a little socially awkward, I guess using baseball as a metaphor, you can only hit the ball when you're standing at the plate swinging the bat. You can't hit it when you're just sitting in the stadium waiting for something to happen. And Don Tillman isn't completely sure why he's at the plate or what lies in his future, but he's up there. He's swinging the bat, And for all his quirkiness, he's trying. He's outside of his comfort zone. He's taking risk. And everybody just sort of roots for him.
That's one of the reasons that we love him, that he doesn't give up. He's the odds are stacked against him, but he's not given up hope. He's going to keep on. And, you know, he never really takes a backward step in this story. No matter what obstacles get in his way, no matter how ill-equipped he is to deal with them, he's going to push on. He's got some real-life skills as well, but when it comes to the social side of things, he's pretty deficient.
And what has Don's character taught you about risk in your life?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. What have I learned from Don? Look, the truth is I haven't learned a great deal from Don. I would be dishonest. I put a great deal of myself into Don, and I think probably more than anything else that it's helped clarify some things in my mind. I know how much of a Don I am and how much I'm not, I guess. But, I mean, I've always been a risk taker. I've tried to reinvent myself a few times, probably as much as Don is. So I'm afraid that's not a wonderfully lucid answer, but you know, I guess when you write a book, if you want to write a book that doesn't feel like it's preaching, the themes that are in that book emerge. You don't set out to change people's attitudes or to convince them that Don's a certain type of person or anything like that. You sit down to tell a good story, and your own values eventually imbue that story. You can't help it. Your own values come into the story, and that in the end is what's perhaps transmitted as a subtext. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I like that.
I do too.
That works for me. So, Graham, I want to ask you a little bit about, you know, the right brain, left brain distinction and bridging the gap between the two. I mean, you as a scientist, you've done that now, and I'm curious about your whole creative process as when you were a scientist, where you sat around the lab or whatever you did, you know, wishing that you could write a book. And you had written books, but a novel, that one that was the greatest expression of your own creativity. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, look, it's interesting. And if I can go back, sometimes people say, how did you move from information technology into a creative field like writing a novel? And I sort of stop them right there and say, hold on, most people I think I know working in information technology actually regard their work as being creative, and some of that work is highly creative. It's just that creativity is not going to be visible to people who aren't familiar with the field. Right? They're not going to read that computer program and realize how smart, how creative that work is. And I think there are many people in what we would call technical fields who are doing tremendously creative work. To be honest, I think writing a novel is a little more creative. I feel I've got to be a bit more consistently creative on a day-to-day basis. But if you like, the toughest problems I face in writing a novel are no tougher than the toughest I faced in the technological world. But you asked about the left brain, right brain thing. Look, I guess I'm one of those people. I remember my headmaster taking me aside when I was 12 years old and saying, Graham, you're quite good at science and also at writing, because I was quite a competent writer. You will have to make a decision in your life as to which one of those to follow. And even at 12, I had already so firmly made the decision that I was going to go down the scientific path. It was where my... But in my early 20s, I thought I would like to write a novel. I made a pathetic attempt, showed it to my friend, and he said, I think you better stick to the information technology. And that just stayed in the back of my mind for a very, very long time. I'd always had the desire, but I wasn't practicing it. I was doing a great deal of non-fiction writing, and a lot of my work was about delivering seminars, you know, writing those couple books on data modeling, all of which actually improved and gave me skills that would become useful when I came to write fiction.
That's right. Well, so writing skills are different than creativity, I would imagine, as you've said here, which I love that you say this about, you know, in information technology and certain fields of science, there is a lot of creativity. We just don't recognize it as such. And it's so perfect. My son came home from his first year in college, just fascinated with computer science. And as he describes it to me, I get that it is creative, even though it's not really making sense to me. And do you think that's maybe where the stereotype is? We don't really understand it.
Yeah, but equally, there are people who don't understand abstract art, for example, but they would automatically, without thinking, but it's creative. Sure, it's creative. I don't understand it. Why can't they say that about a piece of technology, a computer program, a solution to a scientific problem, a mathematical theorem? All of these have required a very high level of creativity.
So back to Don Tillman, the protagonist. He has a rough dating history. He's never been on a second date.
To say the least.
Yeah.
He's socially awkward. And I got a kick out of this. He sits down and watches the movies Hitch, Gone with the Wind, Bridget Jones, Diary, Annie Hall, Notting Hill, Love Actually, and Fatal Attraction. I think he also reads As Good as It Gets. And I know someone like that. I know someone that did that exact thing. They're trying to figure out relationships, and they start watching these movies they would never watch otherwise. And
wow, and you actually know it. I made that up.
No, I know some Don Tillmans. That's that is for sure.
Well, let me say that I think all of us, or any of anyone who works in science, know some Don Tillmans. There's a Don Tillman in every mathematics, every physics, every engineering, every computer science department at the university, and probably in every computer department in every organization.
Yeah, and it's really not that far off when you think about the expression, you fake it until you make it, where you find someone, you emulate their style, and you watch maybe it's a person that gives really good speeches, and you watch the way they prepare their speeches, the way they give them, the mannerisms, all those different things. And until you adopt your own style, you have this role model that you look up to. Well, he's just down in there in Hollywood, and he's looking at these great romance movies.
It's a very deep question you ask, actually, about the fake it till you make it. Because, I mean, I never said Don had Asperger's syndrome. I don't say it in the book. But any psychologist, and in fact anybody in the Asperger's community, will say Don Tillman does indeed have Asperger's.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, that was seen as a syndrome of childhood, a developmental issue, and you got over it, as it were. It just took you a bit longer. And the question really is, have you learned to fake it till you make it, as it were, or have these people actually changed inside? And for me, my own experience is that a lot of very socially competent people who perhaps were diagnosed with Asperger's as kids have learnt to fake it till you make it. But they've acquired the skills, but their internal wiring hasn't changed all that much.
I understand that. I know exactly what you're saying. That's interesting.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Graham Simpson. He's the author of The Rosie Project. He'll be visiting Salt Lake on Saturday, speaking at the King's English, beginning at 11 a.m. for a lunch event.
I'm just sort of laughing. I'm just thinking about a couple of things. I mean, here's a guy, everybody that he meets, he calculates their BMI. You know, I just got a kick out of that. And he's not into music, but he knows he needs to get into music, so he gets some kind of media player. He gets two songs. One is Satisfaction by the Stones. The other one is Darling Be Home Soon from John Sebastian, and he puts them on shuffle. He's got two songs, and he puts them on shuffle. I love it.
You know, one of the amazing things about the book for me is, I mean, I've written it as a comedy, but you're the first person to mention that particular bit of the book as being funny or amusing. So many people come to me and say, my favorite bit of the book is, and I've got no idea what's coming.
Right, right.
Putting two songs on shuffle, that's so good.
That's really, and the selection of the songs. I mean, could Satisfaction or Darling Be Home Soon be any different?
So, Graham, I want to ask you a little bit about Rosie, because I have to say, in my experience, I dated someone that had, undiagnosed, shall we say, Asperger's, and it was fascinating. It was a breath of fresh air. It was without guile. It was, I learned so much, and yet it was so unconventional. So,
yeah.
What does Rosie find?
Well, it was interesting because I sat down with one of the gurus of Asperger's syndrome, Professor Tony Atwood, who's written books on the subject, and he was the one who said to me, Graham, I don't care what anybody tells you, Don Tillman is Asperger's, okay? So stop skirting around it. But he said, he does a lot of counseling of relationships where one of the partners, usually the male partner, has Asperger's syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the women who are attracted to men with Asperger's tend to be either women who think they can change them, who want to help, who think they can show them a broader world, mm-hmm. or they're people who've got Asperger's themselves, whether it's diagnosed or otherwise, who just relate, who just connect, and that's their way of thinking, and it works together. I didn't have that information to hand. I never studied Asperger's when I wrote the book. I drew the characters from real life, from my life experience, not from textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
But and Rosie, frankly, is a little bit of both. On the one hand, she wants to show him a lot of stuff, and she enjoys showing him a bigger world than he's been exposed to or that he's restricted himself to in the past. But on the other, if you look closely at Rosie, she's a pretty quirky person. She's an academic herself. She's not surrounded by a big social circle. She's got some pretty fixed ideas of her own.
Huh. Interesting.
I'd just like to add that where Don, despite his best scientific efforts, couldn't find love, it sort of found him. The same thing could have happened to Rosie.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's interesting. It's one of the bylines for the book. You don't find love, love finds you. And you know, I actually don't like that very much as a byline because it almost suggests that you do just sit on the couch and wait for it to come along. It might suggest that to some people. I think love is something you create. And I think that, you know, what happens in the book is the reason that Don and Rosie fall in love is not because they're compatible or incompatible particularly, but because they do stuff together. Because they set off on a journey together, they share experiences, they help each other, they support each other in their needs, and they find out that they're a good team. And I think that, you know, certainly in terms of longevity of love, you need to achieve that, even if it's not what attracts you in the first 6 months.
Well, they do a lot together. They don't listen to music together. That's probably a good thing. but she was a great character as well. And of course, Don's friends and some of these other people that come along on this journey.
Certainly one of the important characters in the book. There are not a lot of characters. I wrote this originally as a screenplay, and one of the disciplines of screenwriting, Game of Thrones notwithstanding, is to minimize your number of characters, because by having fewer characters, you create bigger roles, as it were. You make them deeper, more interesting. And the Gene character is really, male Gene, as in Eugene, character, Don's buddy, the philandering professor of psychology, is a very important character in the story.
Yes.
And really, he's the third character there. And he was a combination of two characters originally, the Don's good mentor and his bad mentor. And I wrapped them up together to make a more complex character. And in many ways, you talk about faking it till you make it. That's Gene. Gene is the man who faked it till he made it and still has, he's a bit the dark side of Don. I mean, what sort of guy is trying to bed a woman from every country of the world and putting pins in the map to score it?
He has not grown up yet.
He has not grown up. He's got collections. He's still trying to make up for something, I think, in his youth where he probably got rejected as much as Don did, but he learned to play the game. Now he's busy proving he can.
I wonder if we like Don so much, and really your book is loved around the world. It's been an international sensation, really. And I think we're just sort of catching on in this country. But last year it was the number one book, in many different countries?
Yeah, we hit number one in Canada. We got to, I think, number two in the UK. We've certainly been number one various lists in Australia. We've got Book of the Year in Australia. So it's very big in Germany. It's been in the top in the bestseller list since it came out in Germany. But the US started a little later. We published back in January of last year in Australia, and the US didn't publish till October, and that was in hardback. So it's one of those word-of-mouth books. It's not going to be put out in the marketplace and suddenly go to the top of the charts, but it's on the New York Times bestseller list, and that paperback's only been out a couple of weeks, so it does seem that Americans are picking it up and sharing it and passing the word around, which is great.
I'm not sure where I read this, but the number one market in the United States is Salt Lake City?
Yeah. It. I did a tour in December, just a little mini tour in December, and I went to the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City, and I'll tell you, it was as good as any welcome I've had anywhere in the world in terms of the number of people who showed up. I've never signed so many books in a bookshop, I don't think, on one night. There was a snowstorm outside, and I'm sitting there, and I'm just signing book after book after book for gifts and everything, so...
Well, you know, we're a quirky state. We're actually the number two state in the nation for the incidence of autism, and I think we're very aware of it. And not that Don Tillman has anything to do with autism, but, you know, it's on the Asperger's is on the spectrum.
Well, it's on the autism spectrum. So, in fact, he's got a lot to do with autism.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, relatively recently, Asperger's is being reclassified, certainly in DSM-5, the psychiatric diagnosis manual,
right,
is being part of or absorbed into the autism spectrum.
Yes.
And, you know, the only people who I've had any difficulty with the book, are people who've got severely autistic kids who think, hey, this is a humorous book. You're making fun of autism.
Light.
My kid's got autism.
Mm.
And, you know, I really want to say there, man, you know, Don Tillman is in a very different sort of category. You know, there's a range there, and Don's at the end of the range where he's functioning. He's got a job. He does have relationships. He communicates well. He's highly intelligent. Well, and so on. So it's not a reasonable comparison.
Right.
But you might be interested in that context that the country in which the book has done the absolute best is Israel.
Hmm.
It's just been a huge success in Israel, number one for ages and never been out of the top 10. It's been quite extraordinary. So
that's very interesting.
It certainly appeals strongly in some cultures.
Right, right. And, you know, now they're saying, I've heard a catchphrase calling someone on the spectrum, the spectrum. And so, you know, and so maybe if you are appealing to a wide number of people in a state like Utah, where autism is very real and present, maybe you do. And the other thing I wanted to ask you quickly is about Don Tillman. You know, we've come out of, we've been in such this new agey, you know, sensitive new age guy, lots of psychobabble, and maybe someone like Don Tillman, not such a sensitive new age guy, but quirky and therefore very refreshing and a new paradigm.
Well, you know, sometimes I get women in particular who will send me messages on Twitter because Don Tillman tweets, and, you know, via my website, all those sorts of things, and at book events, and they will say, I'm in love with Don Tillman. He's my perfect man. And I want to say back to them, you know, he's everything that modern women don't want in men. He's extremely insensitive. He, in fact, epitomizes a lot of sort of male characteristics that are stereotypical, you know, not listening, not getting what you're doing, responding to all of your problems with solutions instead of sympathy and so forth. But, yeah, he's a different sort of person out there. And I think, you know, I think that
you know what they like, Graham?
Getting people to respond to a range of different people. You talk about the spectrum.
Yeah.
And I think of it like the height spectrum. We're all on it somewhere. But at a certain point, you're never going to play basketball. And somewhere at the other end, you're never going to want a seat in coach on a plane.
Well, I think the reason that women like him is because he's coachable.
Yep.
And that he works so hard to make some changes, even if they're sort of on the surface. But he works hard at it. He works. And when I first started reading the book, I was sort of thinking about Sheldon Cooper from The Big Bang.
Yeah.
And Sheldon is not really a believable character. It's just it's a comedy on TV. But Don Tillman is more of a believable character.
Well, part of that is because we get inside his head. So because it's a book rather than a performance, you know, a TV or film, we get to understand the logic behind what he's doing. And I think we don't have, you know, you can't do that. If you're a screenwriter and you're putting Sheldon on the screen, you can't, and particularly in 30-minute episodes, it's pretty hard to show you the motivation behind it. And all you see, therefore, is the surface stuff, which is comedic or annoying or simplistic or whatever.
Well, they need to get so many laughs per half hour or per 23 minutes or
whatever. Yeah, although a lot of people say it's like being in Sheldon Cooper's head. Reading The Rosie Project. I've never watched Big Bang Theory, by the way, deliberately, not because I have a problem with it, but because I don't want to be inadvertently stealing from it.
Uh-huh.
And I've got a sequel to The Rosie Project that's just happening at the moment.
Oh, very good. Okay, I have one final question for you, Graham. And John, you feel free to weigh in on this. Knowing what you know, would you rather be, as a guy, Christian Grey or Don Tillman?
John, you want to go first?
Oh, boy. I'm going to let you go first, Graham.
Well, look, I haven't read Fifty Shades of Grey, so there you go. But I do know something about Christian Grey, and I understand that this is a pretty troubled man with a lot of money.
Yeah.
So, look, they say a character is a third someone you know, a third yourself, and a third you make up. So on that basis, I'm a third Don Tillman already, so it's not such a big change for me.
You might as well stick with that.
I might as well stick with that.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being on our program, Graham. Graham Simpson, who has written The Rosie Project, and just a great book, and we wish you the very best of luck.
Thanks very much, John. Thanks, Lynn.
Thanks for joining us.
And come visit us in Park City sometime. We're not too far from Salt Lake.
Fantastic. Thank you.
All right.
And again, that was Graham Simpson with The Rosie Project, and he'll be at the King's English Bookshop at 11 a.m. on Saturday, 2 days from now. Should be an interesting lecture. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be back in just a moment to help us all get turned on about math with Alex Bellows. He's the mathematician who, he loves numbers, he loves math, and he blogs about it, and we'll be right back.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
The ABC4 Weather Report comes to you live Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. after the NPR News. Brought to you by Albion Financial Group.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host, John Wells. We were just talking with Graham Simpson. He's the author of the critically acclaimed book, The Rosie Project. Our guest just joining us is Alex Bellows. He's written the book, The Grapes of Math, How Life Reflects Numbers and Numbers Reflect Life. From triangles, rotations, and power laws to cones, curves, and the dreaded calculus, Alex takes you on a journey of mathematical discovery with his signature wit and limitless enthusiasm. He sifts through over 30,000 survey submissions to uncover the world's favorite number. He meets a mathematician who looks for universes in his garage, and he attends the World Mathematical Congress in India, which I can only imagine what that's like. He visits the engineer who designed the first roller coaster loop. Get hooked on math with Alex as he delves deep into humankind's turbulent relationship with numbers and reveals how they've shaped the world we live in. Alex Bellows, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, it's nice to have you with us, and we're speaking to you in Brazil.
I am in Brazil, yes, because in a former life, I was the Guardian's correspondent in Brazil, and obviously there's a World Cup here, and being a kind of Brazilophile, I could not be in Brazil for the World Cup, so I'm here covering the football. So yes, I have a kind of double life. Half of me is Brazilian football, and half of me is math.
That's right. So just like Graham Simpson, who we just spoke to, you've got a good balance between right and left brain.
Yeah, maybe there's a bit of right brain. I'm not sure.
Well, because you've also written these two books on football. You wrote, you co-wrote Pelé's biography?
Ghostwrote it, yeah.
There we go. And then a book about soccer, football in general, and I'm wondering about the tie-in with math.
Well, on one level, there's no tie-in because math is math and Brazil is Brazil. But on another level,
They're both very similar books. So I've got a degree in math, so I kind of understand it. I speak the language. I'm not afraid of it. When I was living in Brazil, I speak Portuguese. I was here. I was among Brazilians. And I treated myself, when I was writing the book called Brazil, I was the guide that spoke the language. So I traveled all around Brazil. I spent a year traveling around Brazil, meeting people, talking to people about their culture, and then explained it to the foreigner, so to speak. With math, my book, I spent a year or so traveling the world, meeting all these interesting people. You know, I speak the language of math because, you know, I've studied, I've got a major in it. And then it's my job to then explain it to foreigners, to people who aren't living in the world of math. So actually, my role is of a guide and communicator to strange worlds that you've never been before. So I think that my style of writing and all my books are written like that.
Those are great parallels. I mean, really, language is a system and math is a system, and understanding them to the degree. And as you say, you're not scared of the language of math. You know, many people are scared of a foreign language, and it's because we think that our brains maybe don't work for either foreign language or for math. And so what would you say to the person that you visited around the world to convince that, yes, we can all think about math in this way that's understandable and lovable?
Well, I'm not a professional mathematician, so I'm not a professor at a university. But I have been a foreign correspondent, and I've, you know, written books. So I see myself more as a storyteller, and I think people love stories.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've tried to do is to find stories that are interesting of themselves, but through reading the story, you begin to understand a little bit about math, and that you get a one of those wow moments. I mean, another way that a kind of metaphor that I used to try and explain math, to say what math is like, is that it's a bit like a joke. So with a joke, you have the build-up, and, you know, the beginning of the joke, and you're like, where is this going? I don't really understand it. And then you get to the punchline, and you see the, you know, you see something in a new perspective, and you laugh, and you think, oh, I get it now. And it's almost a physical thrill when you laugh. Well, laughing is physical. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of intellectual satisfaction also. Math is kind of the same. What is proof in math? You start off like, where is this going? This is all quite hard, and then you finally get to the proof, the theorem, and you understand it, and you think, aha, I get it. And that ha-ha of a joke and the aha of math are really kind of the same thing. It's the pleasure of intellectual satisfaction from seeing the world in a new way. And math allows you to understand the world and sort of wonder at it a bit more. And math itself is a wonderful thing.
Alex, mm-hmm. I understand that since the cult hit Spinal Tap, that you can buy a volume knob that goes up to 11 now.
Yes, you can. And this is because 11 is bigger than 10. So if it goes up to 11, it's louder than 10. Obviously, it's a joke because you're not changing the amp.
But it's a lot of fun.
Actually is reflected in quite a lot of other places. So really the joke is kind of on us. For example, Levi's 501. Why is that such a powerful brand? One of the reasons is that the numbers are telling you something. It's saying, you know, those Levi's 500, this is one more. It's got that extra little thing. It's one beyond. Why was it 2001 A Space Odyssey, not 2000 A Space Odyssey, or, you know, 1999 A Space Odyssey? It's because 2001, it's one beyond, it's a step towards the infinite. It's we're getting more out of it. And one of the things I write about in my book is that we have these interesting cultural, emotional, and psychological responses to numbers. So we're kind of highly attuned to numbers, and we're doing math sort of in our brains all the time without really realizing it.
Absolutely. And I really enjoyed the examples that you had in the book. For an example, Dan King and Chris Januszewski, I believe it's pronounced, demonstrated that an imaginary brand of anti-dandruff shampoo was better liked when it was named Zinc 24 versus Zinc 31, and people would actually pay 10% more for the product that was named Zinc 24.
That's exactly right. The study there seems to show that for household goods, we prefer brand numbers to have even numbers, and not odd numbers. The reason that they say this is the case is because how do we learn numbers? We learn numbers by doing our timetables by rote. So we learn all the different times tables. A number like 24, it's in the 3 times table, 3 times 8, it's in the 8 times table, it's in the 4 times table, it's in the 6 times table. The number 24 is appearing a lot when we're a child.
We're comfortable with it.
Number 31, though, is not in any times table. It doesn't appear. So Januszewski and King's argument is that numbers that we are more familiar with, we process more fluently, and we misinterpret this processing fluency as alike to the product. So we kind of see something that's familiar, think, oh, yes, friendly number. Oh, I like that on my brand. Whereas if we see something like 31, we don't like it. And they had this other experiment which they said sort of showed this or kind of proved it further, which was 2 brands of contact lenses, one called Solus 36 and one called Solus things is 37.
37.
And when people like Solus 36 more than Solus 37, because 6 times 6 is 36, nothing times nothing, or there's nothing times itself from 1 to 37 equals to 37, because it's the prime number. When they added the tagline, 6 colors, 6 fits, so you had an ad that said 6 colors, 6 fits, Solus 36, people like Solus 36 even more than they did without a tagline, because you see 6, 6 and 36, and subconsciously you recognize that from the times table. But when you have the same thing, 6 colors, 6 fits, with the picture of Solus 37, you dislike it even more, because you see 6, 6, 37, and subconsciously you just think, that's a cacophony. That makes no sense. The math is wrong. What's interesting and quite charming here is that we think that, you know, learning the times tables is just pain and pain. But actually, when we see things that work, the mathematical pattern of the times table gives us pleasure, and so much pleasure that we're prepared to pay more for a brand that has a line of the times table in, rather than a brand that has something which breaks the rules of the times table.
You know, this is a really curious example of this big underlying theme, which is we all have a relationship to numbers, but we don't know why we do. And in some cases, our relationship is different. You know, as soon as you mentioned 36 and 37, I thought, well, I don't really like the harsh corners of the 7, but the 3 and the 6, they feel soft and round, and that just feels better to me. So our relationship to numbers, in some sense, shows the way that we process, you know, emotion or, you know, even...
Well, absolutely. I think that one of the problems with the way math is taught is that we're taught that it exists as an island, that numbers are just abstract things that express quantity and order, and that we're supposed to deal with them objectively. But numbers exist in the real world, or, you know, we're humans, we are in the real world. So we need words and symbols, and there are all these kind of other factors in how we approach numbers. And this is, it's not really sort of researched, or the subject's not really broached, and it's something that I wanted to get to the heart of, just to find out what are these interesting responses. And I actually got interested in this because, you know, you're saying there that you have this emotional reaction to the 36 and 37. When I give, you know, lots of talks about math, you know, to all different age groups and mathematical abilities, and when I first started doing this, people would always put their hands up and say, so, well, it's what's your favorite number? And at first, because I don't have a favorite number, I thought this was kind of trivializing what I was trying to do. Until I said, well, what's your favorite number? And people said, oh, well, mine's 12. And it, it's intelligent people contemplating this and taking it seriously. And then I realized that actually lots of people, I'd say maybe about 50%, maybe up to maybe a little bit more. This is just when I give talks, I say, who here has got a favorite number? And at least half the audience puts their hand up. And so this is really fascinating. And the fact that it's very common. And I did the survey to try and find out what's the world's favorite number, just to see if is there any coherence in people's emotional responses to numbers, and there is. So in my survey, it was an online survey, I just said, what's your favorite number and why? I had more than 40,000 people from around the world answered it. And yes, there are patterns that you can see in terms of people's emotional responses. Seven is the world's favorite number. It's always top. But what's interesting is when you look at the qualitative side of it, you know, the reasons why. So the reasons why you might not want to like a favorite number, the most common reason is my birthday. But if you're born on the 7th or the 13th, you're very likely that the 7 or 13 will be your favorite number. Uh-huh. If you were born on the 25th or the 30th, just no way. It's very rare that the 25 or 30 would be your favorite number. So it's that some numbers just feel better as favorites. They feel like kind of more interesting. And, you know, when we're talking about Final Tap going up to 11, 11 just feels a bit more interesting than 10.
Yeah.
10 feels a bit dull. And why is that? Because 10's a round number, so it's a bit vague. 10 kind of means anything between, say, 8 and 12. But there are other interesting psychological reasons
I was just going to say, I pulled up your study and I thought, well, you know, I'll go with the number 8. I like that. So I picked that and I looked at the survey responses. They're very fascinating. And again, it shows this relationship that we have with numbers that I wouldn't have known. You know, that's, someone said, well, this was the age I was when I first realized my own mortality. Someone else says, well, if 8 is displayed in an LED, it means that all the little LED portions have to be on. And so for this reason, when I was a child, I thought every number was a little part of an 8. Like, these things are so random, but people are very compelled by them, which is wonderful.
Yeah, and it can be so many things. And, you know, you said before that 37 has felt a bit spiky, but you quite like 8. So it seems to me that your way of looking at numbers is quite visual. 8 is kind of quite soft and round. And, you know, you are a scientifically literate person who is not going to stand for kind of mumbo-jumbo or, you know, et cetera. But you do have these feelings. And I think that quite often we're told, don't be silly. Don't have favorite numbers as a grown-up. You know, try and treat numbers as objective. But I would say, no, let's play with numbers a bit more. Let's admit that we're human and that we have these feelings. And actually, in cultures like India, China, Japan, where they're a lot more superstitious about numbers, they're actually, the role of maths and mathematics is, socially, is a lot higher than it is in the UK and I think in the US. So I would say that let favorite numbers not be the love that dare not speak its name, and we should embrace numbers more and play around with them, because all it does is it encourages an intimacy and getting rid of the fear of numbers. And part of this fear of numbers is why, you know, numeracy rates are bad, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. We are speaking with Alex Bellos, who's written a fascinating book, The Grapes of Math, How Life Reflects Numbers and Numbers Reflect Life. Alex, I want to ask you a question. Before I do, I just want to mention another example of yours is there's 8 pizzas at a pizzeria in somewhere in England for £8 a piece. And one of the pizzas drops to $7.99. And sales go up for that pizza 1/3 to 1/2. People really believe they're getting a deal, don't they?
Yeah, it was an academic survey, so we've got to believe it's true.
Yeah.
It's actually in France, so it's in euros. But
oh, in Brittany, that's right. Yeah,
definitely
euros.
Applies. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the difference of 1 pence or 1 cent from 8 euros to $7.99? Nothing at all. But psychologically, it feels so significant that it may encourage us to go for the cheapest one. And the simple reason for this, kind of the basic reason, would be that if you have 7.99, that's like a 7 number, because we read from the left to the right, we see 7 first. So 7 is anchored in our brain, whereas if we have 8, it would be anchored first. So the difference between 7 and 8 is quite significant. We sort of don't take the 99 as seriously as we do 7 before it.
That's right.
Yeah, it's a bit more sophisticated than that, because certain things we like have a 99 price, but certain things not, because it gives the idea of a good deal. So when you're seeing that $7.99 pizza, you think, they're sending a signal to me that it's a good deal. And with pizzas, I kind of want a good deal. It makes you feel good. Whereas just say you went to a therapist or a doctor, and they said, thank you very much, your fee for this was $99.99. You can trust them. You don't want a good deal.
Right.
You want something sensible. You say, yes, that was $80 for the session. You think, okay, right, yeah. That's, it feels more honest. So there are lots of different psychological ways that numbers are kind of needling us, and we interpret them depending on context as much as on numbers themselves.
Right. Could you talk about Benford's Law, if you could define it and tell us how it just proliferates throughout our lives?
Exactly. Yes. So Benford's Law is something that was discovered about 100 years ago and then rediscovered about 50 years ago. And for a while, it was seen as almost just like a magic trick. If you were to look in any newspaper in the world and just look, take all the numbers, look at all the numbers, and then count the number of numbers that begin with a 1. So the numbers that begin with a 1, it can be 10 or 11 or 120 or 1,000 and something or a million. That's got a 1 at the left hand side. It turns out that the numbers that begin with a 1 in all newspapers are about 30% of the total. In other words, about a third of all numbers in newspapers begin with a 1. About 17% begin with a 2, and it gets lower and lower, and only about 4.5% begin with a 9. So there are about 6 times more numbers in a newspaper that begin with a 1 that begins with a 9. And so what a magician would do, they would say, I can tell you how many, you know, the ratio of the first digits in the newspaper, and he'd work it out, and everyone would say, oh, God, you know, what an amazing magician. Actually, this happens not just in newspapers. It's wherever you have random samples, random selections from random samples of numbers. And so another place where you get this a lot, pretty much all the time, would be in bank accounts. So if you were to look in your own bank account, or say the bank account of a corporation, what you also need, you need to make sure that you have some small numbers of all different sizes, so something from cents up to, say, thousands of dollars. It will be the case that almost exactly 30% of all the numbers in your bank account will begin with a 1, and 4.5% will begin with a 9. And this law, Benford's Law, is so strong that financial investigators will actually use it as a kind of first test to see if there's any fraud going on. Because if you do the test, the first digit test, as they call it, and if, you know, if it's 50% of numbers begin with a 1, or maybe 10% of numbers begin with a 1, which is maybe the intuitive idea of what it should be, then the red flag comes up and you investigate it because something's very wrong. And you see it, you know, scientists use it also a lot because when you're taking random samples, so with earthquake tremors, you can have all the different seismology data. Seismology data will always go to Benford's Law, and if it doesn't, something weird is going on, like maybe there's been an earthquake that you didn't know about.
That is all pretty fascinating. Wow. Alex Bellows, your enthusiasm for numbers is contagious, and that's a good thing. The book is The Grapes of Math, How Life Reflects Numbers and Numbers Reflect Life. Unfortunately, we're out of time, Alex, but thanks for joining us today, and best of luck. Enjoy the World Cup, and gosh, we're envious. We wish we were there.
I will do. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Thanks, Alex.
And that, again, was Alex Bellows with The Grapes of Math, and oddly enough, in the UK, it's called, the same book is called Alex Through the Looking Glass. How about that? We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you. The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur features live music, cocktails, and Southern Pub Grub. Open daily at 5 p.m. The website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
And thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. We want to thank our sponsors, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT. You're listening to KPCW Park City.